Последних часов это освобождение Платона Лебедева.
Платон Лебедев выходит из колонии на свободу.
Законность и справедливость сразу двух приговоров.
Что теперь должно произойти для того, чтобы Платон Лебедев смог выйти?
Не только дальнейшую судьбу Платона Лебедева, но и будущее.
He was always the other guy in the case. Mikhail Khodorkovsky's silver-haired business partner was charged with the same crimes and received the same sentences as his more famous associate. But when Khodorkovsky walked free in December after being pardoned by President Vladimir Putin, Platon Lebedev remained behind bars. Until now, that is. Russia's Supreme Court this week ordered that Lebedev's sentence be commuted to time served, and he is due to be released imminently if he's not released already. But the court left in place a $521 million tax claim against Khodorkovsky and Lebedev. Khodorkovsky, who left Russia for Germany after his release, has said he would not return to Russia until the tax claim is lifted. But the twin rulings have also gotten the Moscow rumor mill buzzing that Putin and Khodorkovsky may have cut a complex deal prior to the former oil executive's pardon, and that this week's decisions are but the latest chess moves in a complex and high-stakes game. The UK Coast case moves toward endgame, but where the hell is it going? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University and expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Welcome back to you, too.
Thank you. It's good to be back. And joining us also via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean. Good to see you again.
Good to be back.
Since his release last month, Khodorkovsky's been cautious about criticizing Putin and has insisted he didn't want to get involved in politics. He says he's not interested in trying to reclaim his old company, Yukos, most of which has been taken over by the state-controlled Rosneft oil company. Instead, he said his priority is to get Lebedev out of prison and to get the tax claim against him lifted. He batted 1-for-2 on this with the Supreme Court's ruling. But at the same time, Yukos shareholders are suing Russia in the arbitration court at The Hague. And if they win, Russia could be hit with a judgment that could exceed $100 billion. In a blog post earlier this month, Andrei Illarionov, a former aide to Putin and a fellow at the Cato Institute, connected these dots somewhat and concluded that Khodorkovsky and Putin reached the deal of the decade or the deal of the century last year. Khodorkovsky would drop or seek to reduce settlement Yukos shareholders lawsuit in exchange for his freedom, that of his colleague, and a lifting of the tax claim. But things like this have to be done apparently piecemeal, right? Mark, I know this is supposition upon supposition upon supposition here, but Illarionov is not, you know, he's not somebody to go off on some wild theory. He seems to have done his homework here. So it all seems to fit, sort of. But what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this makes sense?
Well, my first thought is that Sean and I were talking beforehand, each hoping that the other one would end up having to be called on first to answer this question. I think this is a problem. I'm more sceptical, I have to say, for several reasons. One is that with Lebedev out, then essentially the only weapon that Putin retains is this tax bill. And the tax bill issue only really applies if Khodorkovsky wants to come back to Russia.
Right.
And we really don't know if that's particularly high on his list of priorities, having been in prison there for so long.
Although he says he will go back if the tax bill is lifted.
Well, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's unlikely that Khodorkovsky, under any circumstances, would be saying, God no, let Russia rot. All I'm saying is we really don't know if that's high on his list of priorities. Certainly if it's worth that much to him. I think it's as much as anything else. Once you've let Khodorkovsky out, what is the point if the big Matryoshka is out, well, why do you worry about the little dolls inside? Mm. To, to keep the cohort in prison is just simply continuing to maintain a hostage to fortune and international public attention without any real advantage. I mean, that said, it could be that a deal has been struck. I just think that, you know, unless Ilarionov has some kind of, you know, inside track information that we aren't privy to, I don't yet see. I think we have too few dots to the point where, you know, if we try and join them up, we're just simply drawing the picture that we want to see there.
And then there's the issue of Alexei Pichugin, Khodorkovsky's former security chief, who remains in prison, has been convicted of murder and is serving a life sentence. Khodorkovsky wants him out, too. So the Kremlin does kind of hold some chips here still.
See, but that's the big one in many ways for me, Pichugin, because, you know, Pichugin actually has been convicted and it's murder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, you know, far be it from me to prejudge any case, but nonetheless, there seems to be more sense that there is a definite case there. We don't quite know the detail, we don't quite know for certain the motivation or whatever, but nonetheless, it looks as if there may be a real case there rather than something that's a purely a political lash-up. Now, if the Kremlin is willing to actually basically let a murderer go free, then that definitely would say something about the fact that, you know, it implies that some sort of deal has been struck rather than just simply an acknowledgement of a miscarriage of justice for political reasons that is no longer sort of worthwhile. Mm. But yeah, I mean, the question becomes quite how important, or to put it in very blunt words, you know, how many dollars is Pichugin's freedom worth?
Mm. Mm. Sean, are you equally skeptical about the fact that some kind of a deal has been cut? Or,
I mean, it's nice to think that there might be a deal just because everyone seems to be surprised by Khodorkovsky's virtual silence since he got out. I think there's a lot of expectation that once he was freed, he would now become the vanguard of the anti-Putin movement. So I think an attempt to explain the fact he's been so reticent to speak out is that there's some sort of backroom deal going on, which there certainly could be, but again, outside of The Hague, which is a big deal, but I wonder how much sway does Khodorkovsky have over shareholders?
Right, that's another question there. I don't know if Khodorkovsky could even control that process if he so chose to.
Exactly. And the tax thing, I mean, for what Ilarionov said on his blog post, he seemed to suggest that he could get around that if once the bankruptcy law goes into effect in 2015. So if he declares bankruptcy, that tax burden would essentially be lifted. This is what I understood. I might be wrong about this because these details I don't know very well. So I really wonder, what does Putin have over Khodorkovsky? And frankly, what could Khodorkovsky do to Putin outside of this Hague issue, which he might not have any control over?
Right.
You know, he could speak. A lot of people have spoken from abroad with moral authority, and it doesn't really affect the internal politics of Russia all that much. I don't really see what there might be some strings, but they're kind of really thin strings in terms of what the deal might be, if there is a deal.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I don't really even think Russia needs this tax bill to keep Khodorkovsky in the country if he so chooses to return and they want to keep him there. They can do whatever they want. Let's face it, it's Russia.
Basically, and why would Khodorkovsky go back? I mean, he has more at risk to return to Russia because they could, you know, slap some other charges or something on him. I mean, they've done it to him before. So I don't see – I mean, keeping him out of Russia, I don't see this. This might be a mutual – if there is any agreement, the mutual agreement is you leave and, yes, I want to leave.
But then there's one other dot here that doesn't make sense, and that you hit on it yourself, Sean. Khodorkovsky's silence since he's been relieved, or relative silence, the timidity in criticizing Putin, the kind of overtures to nationalism, which kind of took me by surprise. I had no idea where that came from. I had never heard anything like that from him in the past. How does that, if he's safely out of the country, why isn't he going at Putin with full guns blazing? I mean, none of us know the answer to this question, of course, unless we can get Mikhail Borisovich to appear in the podcast with us.
I think there's two things here. There's the Khodorkovsky that many want to believe, and then there's the actual Khodorkovsky who's had many faces in his career, right? You know, we shouldn't forget that at one point in the game, Khodorkovsky was a ruthless oligarch, and it's only after his imprisonment did he become a kind of symbol of moral authority and democracy. So we don't really know who the real Khodorkovsky is, and it's perhaps we're seeing the real one. We don't know. But the reason why he might be timid in speaking out is, I mean, the guy just spent 10 years in prison. The Putin regime won in this one. The only reason why he's out is because they let him out. They could have easily pursued a third Yukos case and put him away even longer. He just might be physically and mentally spent from the experience. You know, this doesn't say that maybe in a year, 2 years, or even a few months down the road, once he kind of gets his house in order, he might, through his pro-democracy initiatives that he's going to fund, maybe we'll see him return as a kind of political critic of Putin. But for me, from a personal perspective, I can understand him not living up to the image that people had in their minds about him. It's somewhat not surprising.
Mm-hmm. Mark, would you agree? I mean, do you have any thoughts on this data point of how Khodorkovsky has conducted himself since being released from prison?
No, I very much feel that Sean hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think because we are Russia wonks, we therefore assume that actually the state of Russia should obviously be the sort of central focus of his life. I mean, it could well be that it's not. It could well be that precisely, I mean, he's just more concerned in thinking, thank God I'm out of there. He may well be feeling, well, nothing can be done about Russia. But also, I mean, in a way, let's not forget the stick as well as the carrot. I mean, in a way, if there's the hypothesis that there was some kind of a bargain struck. In other words, the carrots were promised or exchanged. Well, there's also the hypothesis that turns around and just says, look, you know, we're going to let you go. Just get out. Enjoy your $2 billion or whatever it is you've got. But do bear in mind that one way or the other, we can reach out. Whether it's with a court case and trying to get Interpol to put a red notice out on you, or whether it's other, more shadowy methods. Whether or not it's true that that actually would ever happen. I mean, it's very rare for Russians not to believe that ultimately the Russian state has the capacity to reach out to anybody anywhere. And so in that respect, it could well be, you know, as Shaw's indicated, that in fact, from his point of view, he just doesn't have the will, the capacity at present for that struggle. Or he could well be just simply thinking, well, let's wait and see what happens.
Mm.
If you have a sense that the regime is at a cusp moment and that a year or two might well see substantial change, maybe your temptation is not to be the first one on the barricades, but to let other people vault the barricades and clear them from your path.
Right, because he's certainly already been in one form of the barricades himself. Now, this, as I noted in the intro, this comes in a context, of course. It comes following the pardon of Khodorkovsky himself, the amnesties of two members of Pussy Riot, the amnesties of the Greenpeace activists. And it also came when Putin appointed Ella Pamfilova as his human rights ombudsman, replacing Vladimir Lukin, who will be leaving that post. Pamfilova is a staunch Kremlin critic, and I was frankly personally surprised by her appointment. Now, I am not going to say the T word. We're not, or the th word. We're not having a thaw here. But what's going on here? Is it just burnishing the image before the Sochi Games, do you think? Or is something maybe a little deeper at play right now? Sean, what do you think?
I mean, I think Mark said this on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, where you can only free Khodorkovsky once. It's a big card for him, for Putin to play. And if it's just for the Olympics, it seems kind of he kind of used up his big guns in a way, because the markets haven't really reacted
not
in
at
any
all.
Positive way. The image, because of the way the media news cycle is, I mean, Khodorkovsky's release is like a second. It's bad snooze.
Yeah.
It's old news now. Same with Pussy Riot. It's old news now. So maybe he got a little international bump. From releasing, but then of course a few days ago he makes these strange comments about homosexuals,
right?
So you know, it which would tarnish kind of reverses back in terms of there's a lot of media outcry.
But he trotted out Medvedev yesterday to make more nicer comments.
Yeah, but nobody listens to Medvedev,
exactly.
You know, so I don't. I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, it's easy to believe that it was a move to make, you know, Russia look good before the Olympics, but I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, I'm really, really curious as to really why now, why this kind of series of releases. Now, the Greenpeace activists, I kind of understand. Yeah. I don't really include them in the group. Pussy Riot, okay, they were going to be out in a month or two.
And Lebedev was going to be out in May.
Too. Right, and he was going to be out in May. So the big figure here is Hodorkovsky, especially since they were thinking of bringing up a new case. And I don't know. Maybe there isn't maybe it was Putin just working on these humanitarian grounds that, you know, Hodorkovsky's mother is really sick. Who knows?
But I don't believe that.
I'm wondering I don't know what to believe, frankly. And I'd like to think that there's a larger context to this, that there is the T word, a thaw going on. But we won't really know what this signifies till after the Olympics.
Yeah, exactly. Mark, what do you think? Do you see what kind of without using the T word, do you see any kind of larger context here? I mean, with all of this taken together, I'm talking Hodorkovsky, Pussy Riot, the appointment of Pamphilova, the Lebedev's release today. What do you see any larger context here?
I think there is a context. And trust me, having just come in from walking the dog, Thor and Moscow do not go hand in
hand.
Not
in January,
at the moment.
They don't.
but genuinely, I mean, I think that there is a wider strategic context, or I think there may be a wider strategic context that I would put it with things like the amnesty for entrepreneurs. And I know we're going to be talking a little bit in the future about, you know, Bastrykin. But in some ways, if you don't mind, I'll leap forward to include that.
Okay.
Just to sort of flag that up in the moment is, I think that we're also seeing Bastrykin sort of trying to sort of present a slightly different sort of line. And I think the thing is, what Putin is doing, and I've always felt that Putin only changes when he has to. He's not someone who changes in times of strength. He changes in times of perceived weakness. And I think it's an attempt, which I don't think is going to be successful, but nonetheless to try to reestablish a certain credentials that the Kremlin is separate from a clumsy, corrupt elite. And therefore, I think, you know, having a critic co-opted as your human rights ombudsman, that's okay, because it's not important in the grand scheme of things. The ombudsman has no real power. But it shows that you're willing to listen to alternative perspectives. Letting political prisoners who frankly have no real political weight out of prison, again, it's a suitable gesture. It's not just for Sochi, though Sochi might have accelerated the process slightly, because a lot of these moves are not ones that are going to really affect the international scene. I think it's an attempt to begin to reposition the Kremlin domestically. But as I said, it's only, I think, the start of a process.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your favorite subject, Bastrykin, and let's segue into that, because Bastrykin was such a key figure in the crackdown. And then he went silent for the longest time. And now it's kind of a brand new Bastrykin, isn't it? Can you talk a little bit about that? You're in Moscow and watching this from closer range than we are. What's going on with Bastrykin? What's he been doing, and what does it signify, do you think?
Well, I think it's fascinating, because as much as anything else, it's not often really what Bastrykin is doing as what people are being told about Bastrykin that is significant. And as you said, for a long time, particularly, I think, you know, since the Navalny court case and the decision to essentially overrule the Bastrykin angle. I mean, Bastrykin clearly wanted Navalny in prison. And then because of Sobyanin and others, he was allowed to campaign for mayor and such like. From that point, we really saw very little of him. And even the investigations committee as a whole, which up to that point had been sort of monopolizing the kind of security narrative, it was still being mentioned, but in a very kind of pragmatic sort of way when it was relevant to a case. This year, we've seen suddenly it be roaring back. But as you say, a very different tactic. We have, for example, the investigations committee saying that they're investigating the governor of Krasnodar, Tkachev, on charges of inciting racial hatred.
At the behest of the Yabloko leader, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly, at the behest, because Mitrokhin wrote a letter. I mean, you know, who does anything at the behest of Yabloko these days? but particularly the fact that they're actually sort of going after someone who was basically giving the same, you know, perhaps with a slightly sort of lurid dimension, but nonetheless the same kind of nationalist rhetoric that a lot of other people had been peddling. And then we actually had a fascinating interview with Bastrykin in Rossiyskaya Gazeta, again, the government newspaper.
The government newspaper.
In which he was talking about sort of corruption, and he's talked about the need to bring in confiscations of assets for corruption cases, which is obviously, you know, one of the things that no one in the elite wants to hear. But in particular, he made comments about privatization. You know, he was saying, look, privatization, it isn't all bad. But, for example, you know, for my money, oil should not have been privatized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, I mean, you know, Rosneft is majority government owned, but nonetheless, it is not the state oil corporation. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, he's actually tweaking a sort of Sechin, who was once upon a time regarded as one of his allies.
Yeah,
so I mean, I think now either we suddenly have Bastrykin trying to reinvent himself.
Going rogue?
Well, exactly. I mean, that seems highly unlikely.
Yes, it does.
It does not fit. I mean, so either he suddenly had this new thing, and it might well be that he thinks, well, if I'm going to go, I might as well go down in the blaze of glory. But I think that's unlikely. Instead, precisely because Bastrykin is one of Putin's creatures, we can use him as a way of getting a sense
exactly.
of what might
he's
be
a
new
barometer.
Current
yeah.
opinion. And all of it, and again, it's very much plays back to the whole, you know, again, we go back to the czarist sort of metaphor of Putin as the man who keeps the boyars in check.
Right.
And therefore, this is why I think we can potentially put these various strange ingredients and data points together and suggest that there is an attempt to kind of to reprofile the Kremlin.
So would it be fair to summarize what you just said as we're seeing kind of a kinder and gentler Bastrykin, and maybe we're going to see a Putinism with a human face to take two cliches 20 years apart?
Not at all. Not at all. I think it's anything. It's going to be the Dzerzhinsky model.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be the, you know, we are ruthless so-and-sos, but don't worry, we're ruthless against the right people.
Mm.
You know, and that obviously plays to Putin's political strengths and also his own sort of inclinations. And it allows them to target the oligarchs, target the elite when they choose to. I mean, they've tried this before. They go up to a certain point and then they basically they lose the will. So it might well follow exactly that same pattern. I mean, you know, failed reformations are a classic pattern of Russian history.
Yes, they are.
I can say that kind of thing because Kirill's not here.
Kirill is not. Yes, you would have just set him off on a...
So it may well be that in 4 months' time, we'll be on his podcast saying, well, what happened to that particular policy? But nonetheless, that, I think, is the current direction of the tide.
Sean, what do you think? Do you have any thoughts?
I don't really have any thoughts on this. It's I have a question, and it's... Not to sound conspiratorial, but this investigation for statements to incite ethnic hatred, I mean, it's kind of a small fry thing for the investigative committee to go after a governor. I'm wondering if you know anything, Mark, that there's something more to this case going on rather than just – I don't know. It sounds like the weight of the investigative committee is used in – I mean, if they're going to use this, they're going to go after somebody they want to go after anyways, right? So I'm wondering if you have any indication there's something more to this.
Maybe he's fallen out of favor and they want to go after him anyway.
Well, here's something that could definitely speak to that is actually, as I understand it, the division of the Investigations Committee, which is actually handling this investigation, is the one that handles major financial misappropriations.
Uh-huh.
Now, again, I mean, we that need not mean anything because there's a sort of a time-honored tradition that it just simply whoever's convenient, whoever's politically reliable, you give them the job rather than necessarily following the strict departmental demarcations. But nonetheless, again, you know, if we're building on that, you know, these are if Bastrykin is Putin's attack dog, that particular division are Bastrykin's attack dogs. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So they're going after him with the big dogs then.
Yeah, and I would imagine that the statements based in Mitrokhin's appeal to the investigative committee is just the way in. I mean, now they're just going to dig up whatever they can find on him, I would imagine, right? They're not going to stick their investigation to whatever statements he made. They're going to look into his financial dealings and whatever else.
And nor can we really expect that everybody in Mitrokhin happens to mention that they're going to start investigating.
No, yeah, I don't think we could assume that. There's a theme we've been kind of, Mark, especially with you, coming back and back and back to throughout our years of doing this, and that's the divisions among the Siloviki, the investigative committee trying to basically be the top dog among the Siloviki and kind of bringing all law enforcement under its wing. they were kind of, they made a lot of enemies. Where does all that stand now in all this context, right? The context of these releases, the context of the reemergence of Bystrykin in a different form. Where are those divisions? How do they look right now?
What's interesting, because at the moment, they don't really seem to be at the foreground.
Yeah.
Which, again, to me implies that Bystrykin is not going rogue. Because if so, you know, you'd imagine that's the point where the FSB and the MVD would be jumping up and down with glee, because then it gives them the opportunity to tear him down, which is something they've long since wanted to do. Instead, the fact is that everyone is busy doing their own thing, and therefore it implies that Bystrykin is simply acting as the executor of Kremlin wishes, rather than anything else. But to be honest, we tend to get a bit of a, you know, a political as well as temperature deep freeze at this time of year. It'll be interesting to see what happens, for example, if the protest movement begins to revive as the temperatures get better. Then we'll see who has lead responsibility in dealing with that. That'll tell us a lot about what kind of subterranean Silovik politics have been doing.
No, yeah, the deep freeze metaphor is quite apt. I mean, it has been quiet. I mean, I've been struggling to find things to blog. I struggle mightily to come up for a theme for this podcast, as you both know. But Navalny has kind of gone silent. I mean, he's not gone totally silent, but he's not the dominating the news cycle like he was. And I think everybody agrees we're kind of in a holding pattern until Sochi's over. I guess I'd throw this to both of you before we move on to the next section. What are you watching for after Sochi? What do you think we watch for after Sochi? Because there's probably going to be kind of some action after Sochi. Mm-hmm. Some things are going to start happening after Sochi. Sean,
In terms of following the oppositional politics, I'm really curious how they're going to handle the Moscow City Duma elections. Mm-hmm. I think this is the one big political event of the year for opposition politics. And really, how are they going to address having to make, perhaps building off of Navalny's mayoral bid, the fact that he does have a constituency, people voted for him, how they're able to translate that into the municipal elections, I think will be quite interesting. Besides that, I wonder the direction. I mean, based on some of the things that Mark has just said, I mean, what the overall direction of the Kremlin and where it's going to go for 2014, and if it's going to, after this big momentous event of Sochi, how it's going to possibly retool itself or the direction it's going to go for the rest of the year. This is one of the questions I have.
And a lot of that depends on how Sochi goes.
A lot of it depends on how Sochi goes.
Mark, what are you looking for after Sochi?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think Moscow elections are going to be crucial, but I think I just want to pick up a little bit more on the Sochi point. In some ways, what happens at Sochi will determine what we're looking after next. It's worth stressing that whereas internationally the discussion about Sochi at the moment is almost entirely focused around security, is there going to be a terrorist attack or whatever else? That's definitely not the kind of discourse that you're getting on the mass media here in Russia. Mm. Instead, it's all triumphalist TV shots of, you know, visitors to Sochi, stuff being done and so forth. There's certainly no investigative journalism on TV about crumbling, badly built facilities and or floods in the streets and so forth. And that may well be one of the reasons why, you know, if you look at the latest polls, Putin's numbers have actually received a bit of a boost.
Yeah.
He's back up to the high 60s.
Yeah.
Now, all of this is tremendously contingent on quite what happens at Sochi. I mean, you know, yes, medals are nice. And sort of if there's a really good performance or a really bad performance by the Russian team, that might have some kind of impact. I find it hard to believe it would have a strong one. But on the other hand, you know, if there is a terrorist attack, if there is some kind of sort of cataclysmic problem, if there is some major protest that nonetheless makes it through to the Russian mass media, that will clearly have a significance because Sochi has been given. I mean, you know, it, 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 it's hard to overstate the extent to which Sochi is around you in Moscow.
Yeah, I was wondering about that since you're there. I mean, it is really omnipresent. Yeah, it's like it's...
Yeah, and also, I mean, because obviously all the major companies are sponsors, you know, the Sberbank, the Aeroflots and so forth. You know, you can scarcely buy a packet of biscuits without it having a Sochi logo. I mean, in fairness, that's what Olympics are like. I mean, London right. was much the same. But again, what this means is that Sochi acquires a certain weight mm-hmm. that, frankly, you know, a relatively minor sports event, I'm letting my own biases come out there, you know, ought not to have. So it'll be interesting to see what happens and how that spinned. Because even, I mean, you know, theoretically, even a terrorist attack could actually act in Putin's favor if, you know, if it happens to sort of catalyze in a certain way and be spun a certain way. And so that's why we need to have security and whatever else. Or it could go the other way.
Go the other way as
well.
These
are all terribly unpredictable factors. But obviously, we'll talk more about these, I'm sure, next week.
Yeah, and there's a lot of balls in the air. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to add something. Another thing I'd be watching for is how they're going to clean up after Sochi, in the sense of I've seen some indications that after the Olympics are over, now there's going to be a corruption crackdown. Because though Putin said a few days ago that there was no corruption in the building of Sochi, I know he actually...
We all believe him.
I know he even thinks differently on this. And the question will be, what if anything, there's going to be a big anti-corruption campaign in the wake of Sochi to kind of, I don't know, go after some of the fish that siphon money off of the project.
Sochi in a lot of ways is going to reset the narrative, and we'll be watching closely, and certainly next week we'll be discussing Sochi on the podcast. In a few moments, we're going to shift gears and have a little fun discussing an odd photograph that was the talk of Russian social media this week. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
For some people, this photo seems to represent corruption and bad management in Russia. There was one opposition activist who tweeted back, "So this is what the $50 billion is being spent on." For other people, it seems to represent the two people who are running Russia, the president and the prime minister. And a lot of people have been tweeting, one seat is for Putin and the other seat is for Medvedev.
That was BBC correspondent Stephen Rosenberg talking about something interesting he found and photographed and tweeted in Sochi this week. It went viral on the Russian internet. It sparked discussions about corruption, wasteful spending, and poor Olympic planning. It was, well, it was a photo of a toilet. Actually, it was a photo of two toilets, two commodes in a restroom in the Biathlon Center in Sochi, right next to each other. In one stall, with no divider between them. And only one roll of toilet paper next to one of them, which I would have hated to be the guy on the other one. Opposition leader and anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny wrote that the silly picture illustrated a serious problem. Corruption and spending, of wasteful spending, of course. Other bloggers joked that the twin toilets were actually a security measure. If you were afraid to go by yourself, you can always have a police officer with you. Before we start discussing the weighty matter of this photo, let's listen to Steve Rosenberg again describing how he scored this journalistic scoop.
And I couldn't believe it when I went in there and I saw these two toilets and one toilet roll holder. So all kinds of questions were going around my head. So I took a photo and tweeted it. And then since then, it's been like Twitter diarrhea.
Mark, I'm not even going to set you up. What crossed your mind when you saw this photo?
Well, I mean, apart from the obvious one, that's a particular sort of toilet I would not want to be using. I think mainly it's just it speaks to this whole kind of new orientalism of the sort of, oh, those crazy Russians meme. And it's something that, even though, you know, Russians are also participating in this discourse, you know, nonetheless, it's something that also bugs a lot of Russians. That sense that there is a sort of a great glee in the West whenever they can point to the silly Russians.
Is that the feeling on the streets in Moscow?
Well, I mean, I can't say I have, particularly. But you've been talking.
I'm sure this came up in conversations this week in Moscow. I don't see how it could have not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of these kind of plague on both their houses situation. On the one hand, sort of, dear God, what were they thinking of? you know, is it just that they forgot to put the sort of the partition in between, or what?
They've allegedly put a partition in between. I understand. Since
yeah, exactly. But whether that was the sort of always the plan, or someone hurriedly sort of carrying out some useful crisis management. So on the one hand, there was that, but on the other hand, there was the, you know, essentially, if you're the culture of Dostoevsky and Turgenev, you know, you're not quite that comfortable when what the world is talking about is these silly Russians and their multiple toilets.
Mm. Sean, what was your reaction to this?
Okay. I didn't really have much of a reaction, to tell you the truth. I saw it come across Twitter, and I saw it come across my Facebook feed throughout the day, and I didn't really understand what was so hilarious about it. Maybe I'm just have a different type of sense of humor, but I actually two things. I was struck by the underlying homophobia of it. I mean, the only thing I think this fed into people's kind of homophobic anxieties, the fact that you have two toilets next to one another.
Well, that was pointed out by a lot of people.
But I hate to actually be a party crasher in some ways, because I read a blog this morning that suggests that if you look at the picture closely, there was a divider between those two toilets. There's an imprint in the center of the photo showing that there was a divider. And this blogger on LiveJournal worked at this building and said that basically this bathroom was under renovation, and showed that it was being several photos of the process of it being under renovation. So I think it might have been much ado about nothing in many ways.
It may have, but it certainly, I don't know, at least gave me something to talk about in the second half of the podcast. My first reaction was like, WTF. I mean, it didn't make any sense to me. I mean, I don't think I don't think there's homophobia. I mean, I really wouldn't want to use either of those toilets.
Understanding in a lot of Russia, somebody told me this I read this somewhere, that in a lot of Russian soccer stadiums, the toilets are like this.
Really? I lived in Russia for a long time and went to soccer games, and I never, ever, ever saw I've seen some interesting toilets in different places.
And a couple of people pointed out to me they've seen toilets like this in the United States.
Really? No, I certainly have never seen any in the United States like that. But what was more interesting was the reaction. I mean, people pointed the reaction that there was an attempt to tie this to everything, from corruption to all of the issues of the day. And if this was in fact built this way, and I will stick by my original feeling, this is a very illogical way to have a toilet, to be honest. But it does point to kind of, I don't know, wasteful spending. No, I mean, the two toilets wouldn't have cost that much more than one. But just the kind of rush preparations for the games when mistakes get made and something even with something as silly as this. But the reaction of the public, and it was the reaction mostly of the Russian public, because this would have died on the Twitter if Rosenberg tweeted it, and if a bunch of Russians hadn't retweeted it and commented on it and turned it into a meme. It turned into a meme in Russia. It started with a BBC correspondent tweeting something weird he found, which, let's face it, if I saw that, I would have photographed it and tweeted it. It's odd, right? but it would have died there. But it got legs in Russia. And what does that say, Mark?
Well, I think you more or less indicated it, that actually Russians are used to illogicality on the part of the powers that be. Whether it's sort of meaningless bureaucracy, whether it's money being spent on projects that really don't need it, simply for reasons of quota or whatever else, whereas other things are sort of desperately in need, but it's not their turn or whatever. And I mean, I think in fairness also, you know, like most people, the Russians tend to take for granted the things that work, and focus on the things that aren't. And again, I think it speaks, if we really want to kind of link this to the big macro themes, something that we talked about in the past is to an extent the kind of the brittleness of the political environment. You know, that Putin is, you know, unassailable, but in part he's unassailable because there's no one assailing him in any kind of meaningful way. And whether or not, if you actually had a real election with real candidates, you know, if you had Navalny and Shoigu and Putin and, you know, Godspech, Beres, Udaltsov, you know, all standing for, you know, in real elections with real party structures and whatever, you know, whether or not Putin would win, let alone whether he'd win with these kind of margins, is another matter. There is a considerable sort of reservoir of, I hesitate to use the word despair. Despair is much too passionate and strong, but disquiet about the status quo, and an assumption that actually things get messed up, that things are done badly because of stupidity, because of corruption, because of bureaucracy, or whatever, and therefore people are willing to do that rather than look at, hang on a minute, is this just a photo of something that is in the middle of renovation, as Sean was saying, and can we actually see that there's the shadow of a partition? In other words, rather than assuming that things actually would be handled well, and they're therefore thinking, well, then this doesn't work, there is a ready willingness to assume that things are being done badly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think it the reaction represents the kind of sense of absurdity of Russian life, and the absurdity of the Sochi Olympics in general. The fact that you're having a Winter Olympics in a subtropical climate in itself suggests that, and the fact that you're putting, you estimate that it's going to cost $12 billion and it costs $50 billion. It feeds,
and then you
into
try to claim it costs six. They came with a new estimate this week.
And then, you know, the whole question of, like, what are you going to do with all this stuff after the Olympics are over? It feeds into a general sense of the absurd, the skepticism on the one hand, in the absurdity of Russian political life. In many cases, the reaction to this isn't surprising at all. My interest is actually the reaction in the West, because I saw this on the Washington Post.
Yeah, it was.
I saw it on Gawker. AP. I saw it on sports media all over the place. And the only thing I can think of, what I can only speak to about Americans, of what Americans think of this, is just kind of an Orientalism of sort. Like, look at these barbaric Russians; they go to the bathroom next to one another, or look at they can't even get bathrooms right in the construction of Sochi because it's so ridiculous everything that they're doing there. I think the reactions are for different reasons, but I do think that for Russians, it might speak to that kind of absurdity.
No, I think you said the magic word. I mean, Russian, we all know that. I mean, nobody has a better appreciation for the absurd and better absurdist humor, for that matter, than the Russians. Well, on that note, we'll close out. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thank you for the enlightening discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our superhumanly patient producer, Tanya Konchova, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.